ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Remember that Black Mirror episode where you're scored on what kind of citizen you are? For renters, that already exists. Real estate platforms are now collecting up to 50 points of data on anyone who wants to rent a home. I'm Ray Johnston, and on Download This Show, I'm investigating what rental tech is doing to your chances of finding somewhere to live. To hear the series, search Download This Show on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to The Minefield, where we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life, make the familiar strange and the strange familiar. It's getting too long now, isn't it? Every now and again on this show, we talk about this. Sometimes we talk about that. But occasionally something comes along which forces us to talk about everything that's wrong with the world at once. Wow. Today, I think, is one of those occasions. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Waleed.
We are talking about the death of Jason Arday, who was a Cambridge professor. We're not talking just about the death, of course, but the series of events that led up to this. Now, okay. So I'm going to let you set up the, what do we call it, the factual matrix, and try to do so with attention. We can't be comprehensive. It's impossible to be. But with attention to some of the subtleties that then allow us to proceed in a meaningful way.
Okay, look, let me do my best here, and let me err on the side of fairness, of generosity, and as much as humanly possible, brevity. Because there are a number of things that I think are being overstated, including the prevailing allegation that someone like Jason Arday was in fact an academic fraud, which I just don't think bears up to any reasonable scrutiny. What we're looking at here, if we can just distill things as simply as possible, in 2023, by any accounts, a junior academic who only nearly 6 years earlier had published his first piece of peer-reviewed research in a significant academic journal was hired by Cambridge University as professor of sociology of education.
Professor, which is important.
It is, it is. It's full professorship. Sociology of education is a complicated field in which what counts as research, what counts as established learnings, what counts as prevailing methodology aren't settled in the same way as history or sociology or philosophy or theology or something like that.
And should we go further in the interest of laying the context? There's a particular cohort within the commentariat, within perhaps you might even say the landscape of the culture wars, that regards it as a bit of a Mickey Mouse discipline, something that doesn't really have the academic integrity or rigor of the traditional disciplines. Would that be a fair way of summarizing it?
Well, I mean, sure, there are some who would claim that. I certainly wouldn't be one of those.
But I think it informs partly the response.
It does. Yeah. It does. In other words, what is being compounded there is the idea that someone who is underqualified is being granted a full professorship in a discipline that maybe doesn't have the same rigor and then necessarily the same demands as other fields. And so there's a kind of pall that's cast over the entire enterprise that might lead some to believe that this really doesn't bear scrutiny, that maybe what is being served here are interests other than strictly academic interests. And it is worth pointing out here, 2023, I think, is a pretty significant date. This is within 2 and a bit years of the Black Lives Matter reckoning. Anyone who can cast their mind back to 2021 will remember the series of remarkable, some might say, I would probably be one of them, somewhat overreaching protests, surrounding institutions in the UK, the US, elsewhere, charging them with not just historic and institutional racism, but ongoing racial discrimination, that somehow the sins of the past had not entirely been left behind, and particularly bemoaning the perfidious and unexcusable, apart from explanations of systemic or institutional racism, lack of sufficient numbers of tenured Black academics within these institutions. So if you put some of these things together and you recognize that one of the things that the sociology of education as a discipline is trying to do is trying to understand the barriers that confront people from racially and neurodivergently diverse backgrounds, into full those barriers that prevent them from entering fully into academic communities, including as exclusive an academic community as Cambridge is. And so in some respects, the hiring of Jason Arday was remarkable. In other respects, it kind of wasn't, because he himself, and you can see this if you go back and read, and oh, look, all of these links we'll include in this week's show, in the website for this week's show. If you go back and you look at Cambridge University's own hiring announcement, the announcement itself is kind of remarkable, Waleed, on all sorts of different levels. I mean, it's trying to say that the son of Ghanaian immigrants, as someone who lived, who grew up in housing projects or in public housing, someone who is himself neurodivergent, in so many ways, Jason Arday represents a singular, kind of remarkable figure that helps Cambridge University, or that stands to help, or that represents a kind of down payment on the promise to help Cambridge University address many of the criticisms that came to the fore during the Black Lives Matter protests.
And there was much more besides in his life story that made it truly remarkable. I think we could say verging on miraculous, and that has been, I think, a major plank in the way that people responded to this. Such as that he was nonverbal till, what was it, 11?
He was nonverbal until 11, but he was also practically illiterate until his late teens.
Right. And so, I mean, looking back, you would say, surely that is the kind of claim that requires a heavy dose of skepticism. But in the moment, I'm actually not sure how much those sorts of things were interrogated, to be honest, but it was part of this broader story of this Wunderkind, right?
Yes, yeah, that's right.
And it is important to recognize, I think, from the perspective then of understanding later how he becomes a target in this saga, and there are many reasons for that, but just one element of it. It was an appointment that was hugely celebrated. It got a lot of attention. It was like it was an obscure academic appointment like any other, and who, you know, name an academic appointment that you've heard about in the last 5 years. You'd be racking your brain unless you are in the field or you care disproportionately about it. This was not that. This was someone who became not a household name. We couldn't say that. But,
no. But he did become a minor cultural celebrity.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
On purpose. Yeah. This didn't happen as a matter of accident. He was part of Cambridge University's PR campaign that it itself, as an institution, had turned a new leaf in response to the protests of the preceding 3 years.
Now, you say 2023 is important because, what did you say, 2.5 years after the Black Lives Matter uprising, this is the aftermath of the George Floyd murder. Actually, I think it's important for another reason too. It's past the point of maximum woke politics, if you like. Yeah. So to adopt, for the purposes of conversation, Ross Douthat's colourful phrase, the Great Awakening had peaked. I would put that peak 2021, 2022. By 2023, you're starting to see more dissent within progressive circles about this. Certainly, it become a very strong talking point within conservative political circles. So in a way, his appointment is at the intersection of these two things, I think. One is still the residual power of that style of politics, but also a growing skepticism of that style of politics. And then he comes out as, or Cambridge put him out, as the answer to so many of the charges that that had been leveled against it. And when I say that we'd gone past the point of woke politics as peak, That may not have been true within academic institutions, where I think it retained its power for much longer than it did within society more generally.
Yes, well, Waleed, but look, let's also give, I think, the most generous possible interpretation of some of this. That for many of these institutions, if you want to speak of the Great Awakening or the after effects, the aftermath of the Black Lives Matter protests, if you want to think of these as simply a flash in the pan, simply a cultural moment that needed to be endured before institutions got back to normal, to business as usual, to some extent, Jason Arde's hire kind of puts paid to that. It says that there was a kind of reckoning. Maybe that hadn't been embraced fully. Maybe Jason Arde's hire was being regarded by the institution as a kind of PR or tokenistic hire that would give the impression, remember Wittgenstein saying that it is of the nature of progress to appear more significant, more substantial than it is. Maybe there's something about the decision to hire Jason Arde that was trying to give the impression that Cambridge was moving more substantively on the determination to hire more or to promote more or appoint more Black professors than, I mean, and you know, at this moment, still even now, there are fewer than 1%. Of Black professors in UK academic institutions. So maybe there was something about this that was trying to give the impression of greater progress. But the very fact that, to some extent, this had come off the boil, I think we may well be able to interpret as something like a good faith attempt on Cambridge's part to do something about what it came to regard as a failure within its own institutional life, namely its own insufficient diversity.
I think that's a fair enough observation or a fair enough way of characterizing it. I would just reiterate, though, that it coming off the boil was, I don't think, anywhere near as true within academia.
Okay. I think that's fair. But look, can I just also say something else?
Yeah.
Please feel free to disagree with me on this. Cambridge does have a notoriously extensive and prolonged hiring interview process.
Yep.
There were specialists in the field of the sociology of education, of early childhood development, of studies in both race and neurodivergence. There were really significant people on that interview panel. I don't think, Willie, there is any reason to believe that Jason Arde, given some of the things that have come out subsequently, I don't believe there's any reason to believe that he simply hoodwinked the lot of them, that he was a kind of fabulous extraordinaire who was able to pull the wool over the eyes of some of the most distinguished academics within UK.
I don't think that's the charge.
It is.
I think the charge is that they were willfully blind. That they were hoodwinking themselves.
Okay.
That there was a political project that overweened all the normal processes of academic judgment. I think that is the charge. The charge, in a way, isn't about Jason Arde. It's about Cambridge and the lowering of its, or the abandonment of its standards and its vocation in the pursuit of a particular political fashion.
Sure.
Now, I know you are saying that's an overwrought or perhaps overly polemic description. And I think that's probably true, but there is truth within it. If what we're trying to do is describe the narratives that began to gather around Jason Arde as the tragedy unfolded, I think that's the better way of characterizing the narrative.
Look, I think that's fine. But again, it's also worth pointing out that even in Cambridge University's own promotional material, it quotes Jason Arde saying, every time I submitted an article to a peer-reviewed publication, it got violently rejected. You know, that is not the kind of thing that you would ordinarily put out. So this is prior to 2018. Mm-hmm. That's not the kind of thing that you would ordinarily put out on the part of an exclusive, prestigious institution as a way of commending the academic credentials of the person who has just been hired. It seems to me that what was going on in the very decision to hire Jason Arde did have something to do with addressing some of the barriers that prevent young men and women, students from diverse backgrounds, from being able to find a place within a community like Cambridge. And so, it seems to me that there are, we need to be careful in parsing out or in teasing out just what institutional goals were here being sought after. You don't you don't introduce Jason Ade the way that you do if what you are trying to do is to commend his academic superiority. Instead, it's the very fact that his life seemed so diverse, so remarkable, so riddled with obstacles that were one by one overcome. It would then be his ability. This seems to be what Cambridge was saying. It's then his ability to be able to use that experience to help other people overcome similar, though not so extreme, barriers to find their own way into a community like Cambridge.
Let me just remind listeners, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to The Mindfield on ABC Radio National. Waleed Ali, my name's Scott Stevens, my co-host. We'll have a guest very soon, but we are laying the foundation for this topic that we're trying to talk about today, the tragic arc of Jason Ade's life and career, and then ultimately death. I should point out, if you or someone you know requires support, there is help. You can call Lifeline 13 11 14 or Beyond Blue on 1300 224 636. All right, let's now go to where the controversies really start to arise.
And look, very quickly after his appointment, certain concerns were raised about instances of plagiarism within that first article that he published from 2018 in the Journal of Social Sciences. Charitably, they can be described as misattribution or insufficient attention to detail in citations, in quotations. There were other concerns that across both that article and then subsequent articles, that the same quotes were attributed to different interview participants under different names or under different circumstances, which just gave the overall impression of either lack of attention to detail, insufficient referencing of already existing research, and certain irregularities in the collection and presentation of data. So that was already within months of this appointment. By 2025, Waleed, I think things begin to get really, really troublesome. Times Higher Education, anybody who has had any experience within academia knows about Times Higher Education. It is, I mean, what would you call it? The New York Times of the academic world?
Yep, I would say so.
It is an organ of academic scrutiny. So if an academic needs to make a significant retraction of published research, it's going to be in Times Higher Education. If there's reporting about an academic being guilty or acknowledging plagiarism, it's going to be in Times Higher Education.
If there's a university ranking that you want to spruik about yourself, it's going to be done by Times Higher Education. Exactly right. Actually, that one, you'll spruik anyone that goes in your favor, but you get my point.
Yeah. So one of Times Higher Education's most senior journalists, Jack Grove, had been put onto some of the issues of irregularity in Jason Ade's PhD thesis at Liverpool John Moores University. He investigated. He outsourced some of the investigation to other academics who specialized in the detection of plagiarism. There are no racial overtones to this. This is about academic integrity and about a journalistic investigation into allegations of academic misconduct. This is what Times Higher Education does. To cut a long story short, a dossier of findings was put both to Liverpool John Moores University and to Cambridge. Certain reviews were done by both the awarding institution of Jason Ade's PhD and by Cambridge. Liverpool John Moores University said that despite perhaps some irregularities in citation, which seemed to have been put down to an insufficiently close attention to academic standards of citation and referencing. The university said that his PhD stands, and Cambridge was prepared to back its appointment fully, but ultimately Jason Ade hired a defamation law firm, which threatened Times Higher Education with a severe lawsuit if it went ahead with publication, And ultimately, Jack Grove's article never saw the light of day. Jack Grove himself was also the subject of a police complaint on Jason Arday's behalf, saying that he had been unfairly harassing Arday.
And to be clear, what Grove says about that is, I hadn't been in touch with him for ages. I'd send him maybe 3 or 4 emails. So the idea that there was a police investigation, I think he was informed that the police were not going to proceed.
Yeah.
But he was shocked that it had even happened. He didn't know that that had been going on.
And there has been a subsequent apology from the police that it never should have escalated this far. Yeah. Now here's the thing, Waleed. If these allegations had appeared in Times Higher Education, and if they had then been dealt with in, let's just call it, more usual academic procedures, within more usual academic processes, my suspicion is there may well have been some publicity, but it certainly would have reached nothing like what we've seen over the last 6 weeks. The version of questions about academic misconduct or his academic record would have been raised in a more measured and, I think, more easily answerable and a manner, and within a manner that would have been consistent with a certain degree of, let's call it, institutional mentorship of Jason Arday's own professional or academic career.
And would have been contained within a certain subculture.
I think that's right.
That doesn't break its banks into a broader culture war. Should we note here, by the way, Cambridge's response?
Sure.
So Cambridge, in its response,
which never appeared,
right,
but has been seen by the New York Times,
right? Okay, that's an important qualification.
It is because the story was spiked. Cambridge's defense of Jason Arday never appeared, but what they said was Cambridge was standing firm in its determination, quote, to take a stand and speak out against the systematic attempts to erase Black scholarship.
So here we see, I think, an important part of the story and the framing, right? These are inquiries that, as you've characterized them, Scott, are perfectly normal inquiries for Times Higher Education to make. They are met with denials. They are met with a legal threat. They are met with a police investigation. And they are met with a statement from Cambridge that frames this within the context of systematic attempts to erase Black scholarship.
That's right.
So an inquiry that I think you would have to do a lot of work to argue was racially determined,
mm-hmm.
or was about race, is met with a denial that frames it as about race.
Mm-hmm.
That's really important, I think.
Yeah. And look, the other thing that's worth pointing out here is that already in 2023, Jason Arday's original article from 2018 was subject to an extensive series of corrections and post-publication amendments that all appear on the first page now of the online version of that article that demonstrate the extent to which that article needed to be brought up to something like academic scratch. Again, these things aren't coming out of nowhere. It's not fair to say that it's persecution, racially based or otherwise. And it's also not fair to say that there's anything, let's call it, academically untoward about what's happening. But it was the very, I don't want to draw a causal connection here, but it seems to me that it was the mistake not to let this investigation come out in Times Higher Education that meant that the stew kept boiling and boiling and boiling until it exploded on July 25th of this year, when a Substack by a philosopher who has a reputation and has an ongoing academic interest
Should I just say it, Scott?
In IQ disparities between racial groups, and who has himself called for what he calls a hereditarian revolution. In other words, there are some racial groups that are simply have lower IQs than others and should not be admitted at the numbers that they are into academic circles.
If academia was actually a meritocracy, there would be no Black professors.
Yeah. So he published a Substack.
Yeah.
That then gave an extensive list of the instances, allegations, charges of plagiarism and a few other forms of academic misconduct. I think there is something about both the source, the racial overdetermination of the manner in which those allegations were presented, the ecosystem into which it then subsequently dropped, the extent to which it was picked up by the usual suspects in the UK media, it lit the fuse. And then suddenly what would have been a matter of discrete academic interest and a matter of, I would say, proper academic scrutiny, then became a fully blown culture war issue. Here you have it. Cambridge's DEI poster boy. It's diversity hire. It's golden goose into a newly diverse and inclusive future. Here is an academic fraud. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing that I really feel that I must say is that while so much of the focus on Jason Arde from particularly right-wing media within the UK, it was over the top, it was overblown, it was unrelenting. You have something like 250 articles appearing over the course of less than a month, all focused on Jason Arde. While all of that is going on, I really need to say, Waleed, you also have some meticulous journalism that is taking place, particularly from The Guardian, who were far from an unsympathetic investigator, but were nonetheless, and here I think we really need to point to the extraordinary work of Lanre Bakare at The Guardian, did some astonishing work.
Himself a black journalist.
Himself a black journalist, conducted extensive interviews with Jason Arde, found a number of his claims about his own background wanting, raised some very significant concerns about some of his own claims about academic qualifications and institutional affiliations, found himself alarmed by the extent to which many of the claims simply did not add up. All of these things then bundle together. It turned into a cultural firestorm with Jason Arde at the center of it. You could say that in the way that he was promoted and put forward by Cambridge University, he was turned into a sitting duck. Here you have this young academic, still young, 41 years old, at the center of a cultural firestorm on around the 5th of August. So this is within 10 days of this Substack post, 10 days of unrelenting media focus. On the 5th of August, Cambridge announces that in the light of new evidence that's come to the fore, it's going to conduct an investigation into his qualifications and institutional affiliations. Around about exactly the same time, Jason Arde himself says that for the sake of his well-being, mental health, in order to step out from this unrelenting, unfair scrutiny, he's resigning from Cambridge. And then less than 9 days later, he's discovered dead at a residence in South London.
Yeah. And the only element, I think, of that story arc that we haven't perhaps touched on is you mentioned the feeding frenzy. You mentioned that his conscription into a culture war narrative about DEI and so on. But there was also then a countervailing narrative, which was this was purely some kind of lynching.
Yeah.
That there well is put. There. This was not about legitimate questions that could have been asked.
The phrase, Waleed, that kept coming up was the only crime that Jason Arde was guilty of was the crime of being professionally successful while black.
Yeah.
Which to be
a response that continued even after the excellent journalism that you referenced there had been unearthing very serious questions about a genuine story. And I think your point about the Times Higher Education investigation and the rebuffing of it is important, because what would have been a Times Higher Education investigation instead became a Daily Mail investigation. A Daily Telegraph, which is a more serious paper than the Daily Mail, of course, in the UK, but nonetheless has a very particular political approach. In other words, it's not that the story was illegitimate, but the way in which it was pursued, the means by which it was done, the volume at which it was done, and the way in which it was cast onto a much grander screen and given a much grander meaning, I just don't think that was legitimate.
Yep. Yep. And look, can I also say that if part of the original sin in this whole affair was Cambridge University's decision or its attempt to elevate Jason Arde as a kind of representative figure, as someone who could stand in for or occupy the place of a broader group or even some future more diverse academic community, then you could say that that original sin was then both mirrored in and then perversely or diabolically replicated through this further coverage, which treated him again as a representative figure, namely representative of Black academic fraudulence.
Yeah. They wanted him to be something, and in the end, they got the negative image of what they wanted.
Exactly right.
Yeah. All right. Now, that took a little while to lay out. We hope you understand exactly why that is, but we do have a guest who's going to help us get stuck into this. You are listening to The Minefield on ABC Radio National. Waleed Ali, my name, Scott Stevens, my co-host. I should just reiterate, if any aspects of this discussion that where we are talking about the tragic death of Jason Arday, if they raise anything for you, if you or anyone you know needs help, you can call Lifeline. The number is 13 11 14. Or you can also call Beyond Blue on 1300 22 4636. Both of them are available 24/7. All right, Scott, we have a guest.
Our guest is Bernard Balfour. He's Associate Professor in the School of Demography at Australian National University. He's also the Associate Dean of Inclusivity, Diversity, Equity, and Access in the College of Arts and Sciences. He wrote quite a beautiful article for ABC Religion Ethics. We'll include a link on the website, asking really what moral demands the life and death of Jason Arday makes of us. Bernie, you've been so patient. Thank you for holding on. Can you help us find our way through this mess?
Thank you so much, Scott and Waleed. Thanks for having me. It's very tricky. I'm a statistician by training, and so I decided to approach this as a statistical problem, I suppose, where in statistics we have this idea of parsimony, where when you have particularly complex issues such as these, you want to try and find the best explanation using the fewest assumptions and parameters. So in simple terms, we have this idea of simplicity over complexity always. And I believe the Jason Arday case pits two issues, that of academic integrity against academic freedom. First, as academics, we have the freedom to air sometimes controversial and even abhorrent views, but we should maintain the ability to have these open debates. And this is actually integral to academic progress, you know, almost Voltairean, I suppose. Second, we have this idea of academic integrity, and that's basically being honest, responsible, ethical in all your academic work. And most academics have this code of conduct as part of it. And as you've adequately demonstrated, these issues actually do come into conflict. And when does academic freedom trump academic integrity or vice versa? And so one of the things that I actually thought about, it's funny, you have ideas and then it's always listening to little children that you kind of get the best clarity. And my two sons have this idea of communication that you have to pass communication through three gates. Is it truth? Is it kind? Is it helpful? Is it true? Is information accurate? Is it reliable? Is it kind or necessary? Does it need to be shared or said? Is it helpful? Will it be constructive? Will it be beneficial? And in my idea is that in these cases where there is academic integrity and freedoms that are in conflict, actually, we should actually rely on the idea of going through these three gates. Is it true? Is it kind? Is it necessary? Is it helpful? And then when everything passes through those three gates, and then we should share it. And I think that would make it a bit of a better world that we live in, because we are really fractured as a society.
It's a really interesting way of trying to assess particularly academic contributions. Unless, of course, Bernie, what you're referring to there is more the media approach.
It is. I was approaching it as an academic issue, but yeah, we can actually extend this, especially in the feeding media frenzy that happened. That's definitely some of the publications, 250 Were they truthful? Mm. Were they kind? Were they necessary? Were they helpful? Probably not, actually. I think maybe after the first 50 or so, we've gotten the point.
They also weren't about, in the end, a sort of neutral interrogation of a particular story. They were about the things that were surrounding the story, not the story itself. I mean, the classic way to illustrate that is, where are all the interrogations on this scale of white academics who are guilty of plagiarism or academic malpractice or so on? Actually, where they are taken to task for something they've said or written or whatever, usually these kinds of outlets will be on the other side, arguing for their free speech or whatever it might be. Now, I'm not saying they're exactly comparable or identical cases, but you get my main meaning. We have these sorts of stories coming up all the time of, you know, underqualified academics, even in Australia. And I think we have to be very clear in pointing out that this is not a sober investigation in a journalistic fashion of the kind that Times Higher Education was seeking to do, it seems. So those two things are important. All that said, the hoops that you're saying academic discourse should jump through there, I think are really tricky ones to try to apply, because I conceive of academia, academic freedom of speech and so on, as gathering around a particular conception of the best way to arrive at truth. And truth is not always kind. And truth can be made undiscoverable by asking questions such as, is this helpful, for example. Perhaps an unemotive example of this might be within the sciences. A lot of the great breakthroughs that lead to serious, you know, leaps forward in scientific understanding or even technological development or so on, don't come from a base of saying, is this helpful? They come from a base of curiosity and exploring things, because you don't know the implications of what it is that you're uncovering. A similar argument, I think, could be made, albeit differently, within the social sciences, that it is the overarching conceit of academia, certainly within liberal societies, is that they kind of need to be unshackled from considerations of what's helpful or what's kind, because it is in this way that the greatest insights get unearthed. And what we thought might have been unkind actually turns out in the long run to have been for the betterment of humanity or whatever. I mean, I'm sort of doing this clumsily, but I think you get the general direction of what I'm saying. The idea of inserting those as criteria, particularly for academic intervention, it seems to me, would remake the academic field quite radically, wouldn't they?
I don't believe so. We'd go through academic peer review, right? And so when you're proposing something that is a bit out there, like Einstein's theory of relativity, it goes through the process. And if it's really going to be that radical, it will stand the test of time, right? And it will be able to convince someone that what you're proposing is something that is, you're saying is unhelpful now, but it's probably going to be very useful in the end. So I do believe that the academic process, if it's rigorous, should actually allow theories that are a bit out there to go through. But I think what's happening now is that there is this idea that academic integrity kind of trumps academic freedoms or vice versa. And that's the moral conundrum that we're in at the moment.
Can I really want to bring things back to Jason Arde in particular. I do have a very specific question for you, Bernie, and I don't know what I think about this, and I'm hoping that you can sort of help illuminate the way. I do just want to mention something, though. You know, along the lines of what the two of you are talking about, you know, why do we have peer review? Why do we have the review of research proposals and conducted research by people who are meant to have expertise in a particular area? Why do we have further institutions or organs of scrutiny like Times Higher Education, but also, you know, there are any number of organs that try to keep track of retractions, that try to ensure that there is some public knowledge of the academy and academics keeping one another honest. you know, it seems to me that the public good that is being served by those sorts of mechanisms, those sorts of organs, is the belief that there is a kind of equanimity. There is a degree of impartiality. There is scrutiny, and there is accountability that goes beyond vested interests, that goes beyond favors, and, dare I say, might even go beyond what is politically convenient. And, it, you know, one of the reasons that universities then should be so important within our common life, for the same reason that courts should be so important within our common life, and nonpartisan institutions and bureaucracies should be so important in our common life, is that in order for us to believe that we participate in something like a shared reality, we do need those organs of accountability and scrutiny. And, you know, I guess what worries me about those who are saying that Arde should have never been subjected to this, to scrutiny to core, I think they're missing something fundamental about how much we require faith in shared institutions in order for our common life to exist in the first place.
So Jason did go through scrutiny.
Yes.
Before he was a professor in Cambridge, he was a professor in the University of Glasgow. And before that, he was an associate professor in the University of Durham. These are very highly prestigious universities. So the very idea that he was just kind of flown in from just finishing his undergrad with a lot of you touched on the issues, straight to Cambridge is not about it at all. I think what he did research are core issues that are really important about the kind of inequities that people face in Black and ethnic minorities are actually probably due to social class. So I happen to grow up in the UK, but I went to a nice school because I lived in a nice kind of area. I wasn't from South London. I grew up in Edinburgh. So, and that actually is the core and the crux of the matter, where the postcode that you were born with, location matters basically. And that was what he was actually saying in some of his research papers. And it wasn't saying anything. Well, it was controversial to some people, but it was it's something that has been, as a demographer, space always matters. So it's something that we know in Australia as well.
So, I mean, this actually brings, I guess, me to the specific question I wanted to put to you. Do you believe that it was wrong for Cambridge to hire him, given his work in the field of sociology of education?
I don't think I'm qualified to make that discussion. What I do know was that, and you alluded to that as well, was that there was a rigorous process that Cambridge went through to hire him. And before that as well, he was a professor in Glasgow and an associate professor in Durham. I have to kind of reiterate that. Two previous institutions, highly ranked, highly favorable, had actually looked at his credentials and decided that he was a very, very good person to hire. And so there is this prevailing narrative that he was just kind of put on into Cambridge, but I don't think that's the case at all.
I'm just not sure, though, that those appointments that you referenced there, Bernie, or the idea that stating that he went through a rigorous process quite gets us there. I think actually the problem is they thicken the charge against his appointment for those who see it that way. There was a rigorous process and yet it failed to pick up these really obvious things. There was a rigorous process and yet no one thought to ask these questions. There was a rigorous process and yet at the end of it, they're trumpeting this in highly political terms, not in academic terms. The fact that he got appointed by other universities along the way only shows how fully entrenched this is, how deeply insidious this whole project of lowering academic standards for the sake of identity politics really is. And so, I mean, I think you understand the way that narrative would flow. I am not in a position, I'm not in a position to adjudicate on the appointment. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I wasn't in the room and so on. But I don't think we can stand back and say, well, they went through a process. It was a good process, rigorous process. Therefore, well, no, not when the whole charge is about the gist of that process. And so I think one of the problems with this story, and the reason I introduced at the start of the show is, you know, distilling everything that's wrong with the world at once, is that it's a Rorschach test, isn't it? You can look at this and tell yourself a story, an uncomplicated story about structural racism, about the metaphorical lynching of someone merely because they were black and successful. You can tell yourself that story. You just have to gloss over a bunch of stuff. And you can tell yourself the story of DEI gone wild and the way in which this is evidence of that, and that this is really only interrogating that issue. And you have reasons to tell yourself that story, but you have to gloss over a bunch of other stuff, which is all the double standards that apply that don't seem to want to interrogate people who are not from certain minority groups in the same way, or the way in which this becomes a media pylon and so on. I think if I interpret you correctly, Scott, it's only actually by holding these stories together and forcing them to talk to each other that actually any light can be yielded from this. Otherwise, we just stare into the darkness of the abyss.
Mm, exactly right.
And we return more or less to where we started, which is scanning the world for more raw material, more grist for whatever mill it is that we want to operate.
It's a really tricky issue, actually. The point you're making is valid, actually, that there were kind of systemic issues, I suppose, in play. But one thing that we have to say is that blacks and ethnic minorities are underrepresented at all sides of the academic scale. And I think you talked about that being 1%. And he was inspirational. Just seeing someone who looked like you, if you look at the Cambridge acceptance rates among black and ethnic minorities after he came, you can see that the figures were skyrocketing. They were kind of trending in the right direction. And so you have a much more inclusive educational establishment whereby you have multiple opinions so that you don't have just one kind of... And his appointment, to be fair, kind of got at other people. Ultimately, him being there was a very good beacon and light of people of color, just to see that, oh, look at me, I can actually do that. And him being so young and being articulate, being very media savvy, I suppose that put a marker on him. And that's the issue that ultimately was his undoing.
But don't you think in the long term, actually, it does tremendous damage to black professors or people who would like to be black professors, because now there's a cloud of delegitimacy that hangs. Like, I'm not English, so I don't know what it's like to be black in the UK. I do know what it's like in Australia.
Yeah.
And I can so easily imagine that the next black professor to be appointed will face heroic assumptions about the illegitimacy of their appointment. Precisely because of this episode.
But actually, we've always faced illegitimacy of our appointments. That's always been this kind of, if it's not said, it's definitely thought.
So you think nothing's changed as a result of this?
I don't believe anything has changed. It's brought to the fore the kind of systemic issues that black and ethnic minorities face. And I think that's probably... Yeah, it's like I wrote that piece and people are just going, oh, wow, I don't know what happened. But on the flip side, I've had a lot of academic, black and ethnic minority academics who have said, oh, my goodness, you've articulated what I am feeling and the things I'm going through on a daily basis.
Just to clarify, this is an article for ABC Religion Ethics that Bernie Balfour wrote for me. And I guess this is what I was trying to get at when I was asking, was it really inappropriate for Cambridge to hire Jason Arday, for all the reasons that you just articulated, Bernie? that, you know, maybe in a different context, he might have been appointed as, say, professor of practice. That's something that's increasingly common within many Australian and American universities, someone who mightn't have quite the academic qualifications, but there's something about the mix of what it is they do, how it is they do it, and who they are and their experience in life that makes them particularly qualified to give the university, say, a kind of public or outward-facing presentation that can be inspiring, that can be instructive to others, that can maybe then add something particular to the student body. There is something extremely attractive about Jason Arde's work, about his particular, you know, even if many of the claims have been somewhat embellished, there is something about his socioeconomic status, his experience in South London, his own experience of both racial diversity and neurodivergence. There's something about all that that may well make him a peculiarly suited candidate for a place like Cambridge, who is trying to address certain ingrained issues. I guess one of the problems that we then run into is, given the fact that he was then promoted as a kind of miraculous singular figure, well, you referred to him before as a wunderkind, there's something about that that's manifestly unfair for any individual to then have to bear up, much less one who is, I think, in many respects, peculiarly vulnerable the way that Jason Arde was.
Last word to you, Benny.
So there's there's a lot of other Jason Ardes in the world, in academia, who happen to be white. But they don't get the same amount of press. They don't get the same amount of criticism. They don't get the same amount of scrutiny. And that's, I don't even remember who they are, but I know who they
are. Well, that's the point, isn't it?
That's exactly the point. And that's, as I said, passing through the three gates, it's something that we need to try and think about in both our academic discourse and in our lives. And it would be nice to have a nice kind of, you know how kids play, you know, if we can be kids again, treat each other with respect and be in a playground and be nice. We're all taught that, but for some reason, as soon as we get older, all that vanishes. And that's the scary thing. And I don't know, maybe I am in a utopic kind of thoughts.
No, I think it's a lovely thought, yeah. Bernie. And I don't think it's utopian, but I do question which playgrounds you were in as a kid, because mine seemed to operate slightly differently to that. But
could I propose maybe a slightly different gloss on what Bernie just said? If something was inappropriate and wrong and unhelpful to say about Jason Arde after his death, it was wrong and inappropriate and harmful to say before his death. And I think that then becomes the kind of moral criteria that ought to stand guard over so many of our public and political engagements.
This is an episode of The Mindfield that I think has lived up to its name. So, Bernie, we are really grateful to you for helping us walk through it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Bernie Bufour, Associate Professor in the School of Demography and the Associate Dean of Inclusivity, Diversity, Equity and Access at the Australian National University. Our guest for this week's edition of The Mindfield, which is now at an end. Just a reminder, you can, you can catch us next week on ABC Radio National and anytime on ABC Listen. But while you're there, I seek to remind you, jump onto the Radio National website and vote in the Top 100 Australian Books Countdown. It is on now. It is the only election that counts.
Just before we sign off, though, I also just wanted to say that if you are in Sydney, there's a really wonderful event coming up in the middle of September. It's the annual Alan Saunders Lecture, hosted by Radio National and the Australasian Association of Philosophy. And the theme for this year is Ride Up the Mindfield's Alley. It's the return of the moral state, politics, and the good life. For all of the details about that upcoming lecture, you can head over to this week's episode of The Philosopher's Zone.
That's it from us this week. See you soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.